This is Christopher Holmes, and this is another two-hour zero-point show through BBS Radio. It is November 26, 2011. I'm coming to you from Kempville, Ontario, which is just south of Ottawa, which is Canada's capital. And my co-host is James Moffat, who's in Toronto, Ontario. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Okay, good. We're going to have a two-part show today. We have an interesting guest on with us, who I'll introduce in a moment. And then after that, Jim, in the second half, we'll take a five-minute break, and we'll come back and continue with some of the book and movie reviews we've been involved with over the last couple weeks. Okay, so today's subject, our guest is Michael Murphy, and I understand Michael is one of the three producers who, with J. Edgar Griffin, produced the movie What in the World Are They Spraying? And I understand that Michael continued on investigating chemtrails and has produced a new video. And so it'll be very interesting to have him on today and hear where his further researches have taken him. I know I became aware of chemtrails myself only about 5 years ago. And it was after waking up to 9/11, and which I'd been completely oblivious about, and it really led to a period of shock and being horrified as I, through the internet, learned more and more about all the terrible things going on in the world. And I remember at that time one day being out, Karen and I, in the van, and we started seeing the chemtrails being sprayed over, directly over us, and we were kind of horrified and realized we were being sprayed, and so we thought we had to escape them. And we started driving, we got on the highway, and we kept drove and drove, but no matter how we drove, they were spraying there too. So we traveled from our house down about 40 minutes to Brockville, Ontario. Then we realized, oh, there's no escaping this. It's being done over our whole area. So we came home, I think, somewhat defeated and really not understanding it all, which I think we still don't. And since then, over the last years, I watch the skies a lot. And I do it for different reasons. Being myself interested in magic and the idea of there being elements, I like to be aware of the air and the sky and the land and the elements in nature. So it's natural for me to keep an eye on the skies. So I watch the clouds and the weather, and part of that is watching chemtrails. And I think it's a very serious problem, and I'm really very pleased to have Michael with us today. His name was sent out through BBS Radio to the different hosts, and when I saw his name there, I picked up, and I'm pleased to have him here today. Michael, welcome. I don't know much about you, Michael. I'd really like to give you the floor a bit to begin, where you'd like to introduce yourself and your earlier movie and then your current work.
Right. Well, thanks for having me on today. It's a wonderful day here in Los Angeles. We don't see any trails today. That's pretty unusual for this time of year, but we released What in the World Are They Spraying just over a year ago. Since that time, it's been estimated about 10 million people have seen that film, many for the first time who have been introduced into this issue. And it's been really effective, and one of the reasons G. Edward Griffin and I really sat down and decided what approach to take on this. And we wanted to look at this from a scientific angle. So I went out and spoke with many scientists, politicians, traveled around the world investigating this. We even spoke with geoengineers and got them on film talking about their models to spray 10 to 20 million tons of toxic aluminum into our sky, which we'll talk about in just a little bit. But
you said 10 to 20 million tons of aluminum dioxide?
Well, aluminum oxide.
Oxide.
I think it's been, important before we move on to discuss really what geoengineering is. Geoengineering is defined as the artificial modification of the Earth's climate systems. That means that corporations, geoengineers, as well as governments have an interest, and they have been developing models on changing the very essence of our natural environment. Specifically, what we see in the sky, and many people are calling chemtrails, is really scientifically worded as stratospheric aerosol geoengineering. So we started the film out, and this is really where I became interested in this issue in San Diego, and there was a geoengineering conference. At that meeting, we listened to some of the top geoengineers in the world, again, talking about their models, which includes spraying 10 to 20 million tons of toxic aluminum into our sky. The geoengineers were very open about some of the toxicity and some of the damage that these programs are incurring and will incur in the future. But again, what people have been seeing in the sky matches geoengineers' plans exactly, and there are numerous patents that have been designed to specifically spray aluminum oxide, barium, and other things into our sky. So it was it's an issue that became deeply concerning of me, and during that meeting, I met some other activists who were deeply concerned about this, and the second part of our film, and I know I'm kind of long-winded, but it started in Northern California, and about 8 years ago, some of the scientists in that area began noticing that the ecosystem in that area was collapsing. Trees were not growing, the forest was collapsing, things were blooming, if they were blooming, out of season. A lot of natural organic foods were not growing, so they began to do pH tests of the soil, and they found out that the soil was changing rapidly from what typically was an acidic soil to an alkaline soil, and we're not talking about 1 to 2 times the normal alkalinity. We're talking about significant changes between about 10 to 12 times the normal alkalinity. Now, anybody with basic science knows that plant life that requires an acidic soil will start to die once that soil pH changes, exactly what's happening. But what really tipped them off, they knew there was something wrong. They began testing the rains. And what they found was deeply concerning. They found aluminum, barium, and strontium. And in some cases, within just a short time, those levels increased several thousand percentage points. Those oxides, those metals, aluminum, barium, and strontium, will change a pH of the soil. So just bringing back what we were talking about, what they are finding in the rain, again, matches exactly what's expressly outlined in numerous geoengineering models, matches numerous plans, and what we see in the sky matches those plans exactly, and again, they match numerous patterns. They didn't have these problems before the trails were there, and obviously the trails are from geoengineering programs. So it's deeply concerning. I want to point out these changes in these metals are not just showing up in Northern California. These are now a worldwide phenomenon found in most countries, but not every country around the world. So it's deeply concerning because of the toxicity to ecosystems, but many more reasons, which hopefully we'll talk about.
Wow, it's horrifying and astonishing. I mean, I must say, to be honest, I don't believe in the sense that it's for geoengineering. I mean, my tendency is to think that they're using it to spread illness intentionally. I'll have to explore that. But at the same time, see, how then do they think that these oxides, which they put in the air, which all because of a very well-known law called gravity, fall down are inhaled by all the people living below? How are they saving the planet through putting these things into the air? And do they have any scientific evidence that it has the intended effects as such?
I think that's a great question, and again, what I think I'd have to point out is that geoengineers state that their models to spray these substances into our sky are to mitigate global warming. What they're saying that that spraying these toxins into our sky will actually, because of the reflectivity of the properties of aluminum, it will actually block the sun and mitigate some of the global warming. However, I think it's important to note, upon our investigation, we found numerous studies which indicated that putting aerosols into our sky temporarily would create a cooling effect, but actually create an overall warming of the planet because those aerosols act as a blanket, and they actually trap heat in. So we've seen an increase in nighttime highs come up, exactly what's been expected. So
So as far as you're aware of, there is no scientific evidence proving conclusively that this is having like a certain effect, like a certain amount of heat per certain volume of substances sprayed on us. There's no evidence establishing that and the value of that program that you're aware of.
Well, and not that I'm aware of, but there are actually, again, studies that show that putting those aerosols into our sky will warm the planet. So then the question remains, why would they do this? Why would they put toxins into the sky? There are many different theories. And I like to call these multi-agenda operations. So they achieve many different goals. And I really believe that the number one goal of these programs, although there are many, you had mentioned, people are getting sick. We'll touch on the health implications, but weather control. And when we're back at the geoengineering conference, I recalled, and we have on video, geoengineers talking about their ability to heat up over 400 square miles of our atmosphere. And, if they're just trying to block the sun, what would heating up the atmosphere, how would that help? So it didn't make sense. We looked into it a little bit and came to find out that while aluminum is very reflective, it's also a very effective conductor in our atmosphere due to its lightweight and other properties. So with various technologies that use frequency, you can actually heat up that aluminum and raise our atmosphere and create high-pressure systems and low-pressure systems.
Would that involve the HARP facilities that would be able to use the aluminum as a screen to reflect its beams off?
Well, I think the HARP system would actually be used because in the HARP patents, you'll note that it requires a plasma sky. What is a plasma sky? It is a sky with aerosols in it. So the HARP system uses frequency, and the theory is that the HARP is being used to actually heat up these parts of the atmosphere and, again, creating high-pressure systems, low-pressure systems, and steering storms. So many people can relate to the awkward and the weird weather that we've been having. We believe it's directly related to these programs. I also just returned from an aerosol research conference, and I spoke with a lot of scientists, and I came to learn that by putting aerosols into our sky, it will change our clouds, it will change our precipitation, and it could enable, through the use of other technologies, certain corporations to literally control our weather. So what they're doing many things with these programs, but what they're doing is they're corporatizing our weather. And, when I first heard that, I said, why would somebody want to control the weather? Well, there are many different reasons, and I just came out, as you know, with a new trailer to a film that I'm working on called Why in the World Are They Spraying? And that can be found on my website, truthmediaproductions.us. What we came to find out, there are not only monetary reasons for weather control and weather modification. As we've seen, weather is being traded as a commodity on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. So wow. Certain corporations have a financial benefit financially by hedging their risk on the weather. So if they have inside information, most people think our weather is natural. It is not today. It is completely controlled. Do corporations profit from this? Do they have a profit motive by controlling this? And the answer is yes. But then there's a greater agenda behind it, and we're not talking about weather modification. We're not talking about financial, but we're talking about complete weather control. And somebody explained it to me. If a certain entity, certain corporations, along with governments, control our weather, you can literally control everything. You can control food supplies. and political systems, and that's what's happening. So let's say if you have a country who is not playing ball with the New World Order agenda. They're not down with global governance. This country wants to keep their natural resources. They want to remain sovereign. Well, if you can control the weather, you can create droughts, you can create floods, literally bring that country down to its knees. And I think that's what we're seeing in a bunch of different regions. And we look at the Monsanto connection and how certain seeds, if there's a country that wants to remain natural and organic, however, you have an interest in Monsanto, and we know Monsanto has many interests with many different governments. Well, if they won't accept your seeds, you can create droughts, making the farmers become dependent on these GMO drought-resistant seeds. So it's a very powerful tool for bringing about this evil government. And it's deeply concerning because it's at the expense of every living thing on the planet. These programs are so toxic.
Yeah, it's overwhelming. It's so disgraceful. It's like these people have no feeling for the planet, no honoring of nature or other human beings. It's really quite astonishing. You mentioned Monsanto. I understand also, are you familiar with the claim that Monsanto is also developing seed lines that grow in alkaline soil or aluminum based soil more?
We actually covered that in What in the World Are They Spraying, and it was very interesting because we went to Hawaii. We filmed in Hawaii for a week, and this was for What in the World Are They Spraying, and it was just a beautiful experience for me. We stayed on an organic farm for about 5 days, And if I could tell you a little story about my experience, perhaps it'll help, you know, it'll help some of the listeners kind of get an idea of what we're dealing with. Anyways, we got in the evening, and we're on this organic farm, and we woke up the next morning, and I was starving. I was really hungry. So I asked some of the people on the farm, I said, is there a store around here? I'm really hungry. Or is there a place where I can get something to eat? And they all kind of chuckled and rolled their eyes, and I said, what are you laughing at? They said, look around. They said, there's food all around. And it was right. I mean, it was beautiful. It was an incredible way to spend 5 days, because during that time, we got our food off of the trees and off of nature. And during that time, I really began to admire the way that the people on the farm lived, because they were dependent on nature. They were dependent on rain, sun, and natural seeds for the food supply. They didn't go to work for a corporation so that they could eat, and they didn't go to a grocery store for the food. It was all right there, and I began to really get the feeling like maybe that's how initially God had created the earth, that maybe that's how we were supposed to live. Anyways, during that time, we were continuing on with our research. Just as you stated, I had learned that looks like they have a connection, but it wasn't great enough to put in the film. But there has been a new aluminum resistant seed that has been patented. That patent is owned by the USDA and Brazilian government, and it really hit me because a lot of people on the island, and as you'll see in a video that I also produced, Hawaii Revisited. You can put that in Michael J. Murphy's Hawaii Revisited. Just YouTube it. You'll begin to see what is happening in Hawaii. Many organic farms there are having a tremendous difficulty growing certain crops. And as I illustrated in that video, I've interviewed several farmers, all of which have seen up to a 50% decline in their ability to grow certain crops. So the concern is this. We know our soils are being toxified with aluminum. We know aluminum destroys plant life. Could it be in part an agenda to destroy people's ability to grow natural organic foods so that they become dependent on these GMO foods and these GMO seeds? And I think that's what we're dealing with. I think we're dealing with the system. It's just corporate governmental conglomerate. I call it the beast that wants to completely destroy natural systems so that these natural systems then become usurped by them and under their control and their authority. And I think that's what we're seeing. It's prophesied in many different religions, and I think that we're seeing this come to fruition. Did I say that clear enough? I hope.
Oh yeah, yeah. You're speaking very clearly.
Okay.
I'm going to open up. Jim, did you have any kind of comments or questions? I invite you to step in. And
who is doing this? Who's doing the spraying?
Well, that's a challenging question. There are many. These are worldwide programs. They're multi-billion, if not trillion-dollar operations. There are many different governments and many different corporations involved. So it's again, many different corporations, many different governments. And again, geoengineers want to do this on a worldwide scale. Spraying has been reported just about over every country, over every NATO country, just a couple of places in South America, some countries in Africa that haven't reported spraying. But again, geoengineers want to do this over every region. So I haven't specifically investigated who is doing this yet, but really the goal in When the World Are They Spraying was to prove that, yes, we are being sprayed, and these programs are very much a threat to human health and ecology.
I wonder what you've learned of where these planes are flying out of. Like, I've heard the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, I've heard the claim that is one of the sites in the eastern U.S. Are you aware of other sites where these planes all... I mean, this is a massive, massive operation. Are there not reports somewhere of all these planes taking off and landing, and they seem also to be silver-colored planes without markings. Photograph them.
Sure. Well, there have been silver-colored colored planes, but many different colored planes which have been recorded spraying. So it's not only limited to that. And again, being that these are worldwide programs, it's not only one airport. Evergreen Air, which used to be a CIA company, Air America, is believed to be one of the many airlines or corporations involved with this. They fly out of Marana, Arizona, and a number of other airports. They boast about their ability to fly out of most major airports with their tanker airplanes, which can spray and do cloud seeding. So people can go onto that website and look at them. But again, it's not only one airport, it's not only one Air Force base. These programs are huge, and they are worldwide. So it's many, many different. And, you know, I'm hoping to investigate that perhaps in my third film, where we can go more into depth and look specifically where they're flying out of. But again, there are still thousands of questions that remain to be answered. But we do know for sure these programs are in full-scale deployment. They're very toxic to human health and ecology, and we're starting to find out that there are links to weather control, perhaps to the GMO seed market, in other things. So, yeah, there's a lot more that we have to uncover, but as an investigator, I think it's at the utmost importance to not speculate on things, because then that brings us into this theory. And What in the World Are They Spraying was not a film about theory. It was a film about fact. And that's why it's been so effective. And, again, not that theorizing is a bad thing. I think it's been demonized by the corporate mainstream media for obvious reasons, so that people don't question this. But again, for this investigation, we're hoping to be dead solid on. So it takes a bit of... we have to be a little careful in terms of what we present, but I think we've blown the doors wide open on this so far.
Yeah, it's so valuable what you've done to establish it, as you say, on a scientific basis, like beginning at basics, and establish that the spraying is being done, and what the main substances are and some of the motives apparently for it. It reminds me sometimes, though, it's like I have a background. I work in prisons for 12 years, so I have a background in forensic psychology. And it's like when you talk to a pathological liar, what do they do when they're caught in a lie? Well, they tell another lie. So firstly, they begin by lying, by denying anything's being done. There's nothing unusual. It's just contrails. And then they maintain that lie for a certain period of time. And then when there's overwhelming evidence that their first lie is a lie, then they have to switch. So now they geoengineering to save the planet and to save humankind. And that's their new lie. That's how I see it. Because the fact of the matter is, if they're spraying these substances into the atmosphere, there is a law called gravity. They do fall down. We do breathe them in. They're not just poisoning the soil, they're poisoning the people. And we have massive upsurge of Alzheimer's and respiratory illnesses, Morgellons and sick, and you know, chronic fatigue and these other kinds of illnesses that people can't determine the causes of. And now they have this is a delivery system. So they can try to maintain the lie that they're geoengineering the planet to save humanity because they're just pathological liars. And that's what they do when they're caught in one lie. They tell a new lie. Any comments, Michael? I'm sorry, I step out a little bit further on the limb because to me, if that isn't their intention to poison the population, that is in fact what it's doing. Fact that maybe it has some effect in weather modification, I'm not denying that. I agree with that. But this is being done by the program, whether or not that's their intention. And they're not stopping it so that they don't poison people. Any comments, well, Michael?
You're absolutely correct. And I think it's important to cover that issue of poisoning. And we know that aluminum oxide is very toxic. We've seen aluminum-related illnesses go through the roof since the inception of these programs in the past 10 years. Barium is very toxic. It lowers our immune system, creates high blood pressure. Strontium, one of the other main ingredients, is it's a carcinogen. So all of these substances accumulate in the body. They will compromise the immune system and with all the other toxins. And let's remember, what they're spraying is not only limited to what we covered in the film. There's a number of different things that are being uncovered. So it's important to note that many of these criminal elite, the Rockefellers, Rothschilds, even Bill Gates, who, by the way, is a funder into geoengineering programs, and that's for public record, these people talk about their desire to reduce the Earth's population through eugenics. Many people are unaware of this, but Bill Gates' father, many people think he was just some random geek, you know, who started Microsoft in a garage, and he might have been, but his father worked very closely in a very major eugenics program called Planned Parenthood, which used to be called the Negro Project, and he worked closely with Margaret Sanger, who, and I quote her, started Planned Parenthood to, quote-unquote, get rid of the Negro problem. These people are evil. They have intentions of reducing certain populations. That includes you and I, because they think that the Earth has a population problem and they need to bring it down to a controllable level. So, you know, without a doubt, do I think when they started the ideas and these models, do I think that they said, how can we quickly decrease the population while maybe spraying, you know, chemicals into our sky would do that? I really don't think that was probably their primary objective, but they certainly knocked down one of the pins in the bowling alley with these programs, and obviously health is not a concern of theirs because they do want to reduce the population. So I think it's important to note that. But getting back to what you said about lying, I mean, you're absolutely correct. Now, geoengineers are denying that these programs have even been started. What they're saying is these are models in case we have to do it to save everybody. Look how great we are. We're going to spray these toxins into the sky. It's going to have a lot of risks. You know, some of you in Africa and Asia are going to have droughts. It's going to destroy our ozone. So once we start, we won't be able to stop. because we'll have to put that up there because there won't be an ozone left, and some of you are going to get sick, some of you are going to die, but it's for the greater good of all of you. Look how good we are. So that's what they're saying.
Yeah.
But the truth of the matter is these programs give certain entities the ability to play God. Controlling the weather gives godlike power. Geoengineer David Keith said geoengineering gives man godlike power. So think about it. Getting back to the deception. Think if these guys were honest. Hey, world, guess what? I've got some great news for you. I have a way to enable me to control weather. It's going to give me incredible power, and many of you are going to get sick. A lot of you farmers over there are not going to be able to grow your crops. I'm sorry, people of Africa, people of Asia. You guys are going to starve to death, but aren't you excited that I'm going to have godlike power? Of course, nobody would buy that. So they have to use deception. They have to sell it to an unsuspecting public. Yeah, it's something that's good for the masses, and that's the only way that people will buy into this. And that's why I think it's so instrumental, and I really want to thank you guys for covering this and for bringing this to the public, because there's no greater issue, greater threat to human health, to ecology, than these programs, and people need to become aware of what we're faced with and what we're dealing with. So I want to thank you guys.
Well, I want to thank you, but I mean the excellent work, your earlier movie, and that you're sticking with this. And Jim and I have discussed chemtrails on the show here for several years now. You're welcome to be on, Michael. And this is just so important. It's just horrendous. 10 to 20 million tons of these poisons being sprayed upon the citizenry of the North America. And it's terrible. It's terrible. These people have there's something so deviant in them. It's funny. When I see chemtrails, I see it as it's biological warfare. And I think the people who are spraying the chemtrails need to be criminally charged under the anti-terrorist legislation, because they're doing it for a political and ideological cause, and they're doing it. It causes extensive damage to crops and gardens and people and animals and the water. So I think that I see it as a form of terrorism being perpetrated against us. So I see it. It is, to me, as clear evidence as 9/11 was of the criminal element that runs our societies, that they would allow this to be done. Like, why would the U.S. Air Force allow the American citizenry to be poisoned from the skies? Only because they're engaged in treasonous activities, in my view. I can't see any other. They're involved in these operations, terrorist activities against the citizens of the United States. I know that's a bit of a radical view, Michael. How can I sound that out with you?
Well, you're absolutely correct. These programs are illegal. They're hurting people. And the Americans who are involved with this and with these programs over the U.S. are involved in treason. And make no mistake, I think that we serve a very loving God, but I believe that we serve a just God as well. And, we hope that the light in what we're trying to do is completely shed light on these programs and shed light on the criminals behind these. These people are murderers. They're creating slow deaths. Yeah, and they're doing it all for money and power and whatever other purpose they
because
they
it
may
seems
be doing.
The same people who spray us with the chemtrails happen to own the pharmaceutical companies and want to ban all natural health products. It's kind of like the same networks of people.
Well, it is, and if you look at the UN's influence on Codex Alimentarius, the Food Safety Act, which was proposed but had failed, they're trying to move forward to actually make nutritional products illegal and label them as toxins. So, we truly live in a season where the things that are good are being called bad, and the things that are bad are being called good. So it's very concerning to us. But again, this is at the structuring, the final structuring of this very oppressive system that desperately wants to change the things that are under authority. And I think we spoke about this a little bit. What they're doing, they're changing things that are under the authority of creation or authority of nature. They're genetically altering it so it becomes under the authority of man. That's exactly what's happening. So this authority is being usurped, and it's because these people want godlike power. And we're dealing with, and you would probably be able to elaborate, sociopaths. This is what we're dealing with. A lot of people, including myself at one time, it was very difficult for me to relate with this. I said, you know, it just can't be. How could these horrendous things be happening? And, you know, it wasn't until somebody explained to me, not everybody thinks the way that we think. Not everybody holds the same value system. And then we begin to realize that certain people do have different motives, different agendas, but different psychologies than the most of us. And we begin to learn that, yes, these terrible, horrible things are not only happening, but they are being orchestrated, perhaps by the very people that we were told throughout our whole lifetime to trust and to put faith in, that being many of our leaders in the upper levels of government.
Yes, I mean, partly people are so compartmentalized, and also so many politicians, they like to maintain their plausible deniability, so they don't want to consider different issues so that they can maintain their plausible deniability. I think a question I hear most, Michael, from people when I try to explain aspects of chemtrails to them is, well, that doesn't make sense. They'd be poisoned too. Why would they do it? How do you respond to that?
Oh, you know, that's a great question. I've probably answered it well over 1,000 times because it's asked on every radio interview and every speaking engagement that I have. I have two theories on this, and we have to realize there are really two tiers of people involved with these programs. There's the people who might be flying airplanes or transporting the chemicals or dealing with the logistics. And you had mentioned the word compartmentalization. A lot of people aren't aware that they're involved with this. If anybody questions that, let's look into the Manhattan Project, where there were thousands of people who were involved but had no idea what the overall agenda was. But anyway, some of those people know what they're doing, and I'm sure they're told what they're doing is really good and it's top secret. And, you know, maybe if you told everybody the good that you were doing, they'd get so excited they wouldn't be able to work. And I say that very sarcastically. But anyways, I'm sure that the people who are aware of it are told that what they're doing are good. But then there's a second class of people, and those are the people who know what this is doing. They have planned this, and they're carrying out this agenda and gaining a tremendous amount of power. And I have two theories on that. The first one probably is less likely, but I know that I'm taking certain substances, supplements, natural supplements, to remove the heavy metals, the other toxins from these programs out of my system. And I think the people who are orchestrating this, who call themselves the elite, I call them the criminal elite, have better access to far greater health care and systems of removal. And I think that's a possibility. But my second theory, I think, is right on. And that theory is this. Again, geoengineer David Keith said geoengineering gives man godlike power. I've never chased godlike power, and probably very few of the listeners have. But I'm sure it's a heck of a rush. And, you know, I think most of us can relate to a family member or a friend, perhaps, who's become addicted or dependent on a certain amount of on a drug. And we've seen these drug addicts go through tremendous lengths, even putting their health and their family members' health at risk in order to get the rush of that drug. How much greater of a rush is godlike power? And that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with people who are willing to go to anything in order to chase that addiction of godlike power. Power is an addiction. And I think that's what's happening.
Your comments remind me of two quotes. Well, one that I often use is J. Edgar Hoover. He says, the individual is handicapped by coming face-to-face with a conspiracy so monstrous he cannot believe it exists. And I think that's very profound, because people can't conceive that there could really be a class of people who were like this, who could do such deviant things against people in such an underhanded way. And the second quote that your comments remind me of is listening to Henry Kissinger, where he kind of says, like, thou power is my aphrodisiac. And he says it's like power is his aphrodisiac. And in the spiritual psychology that I teach normally through this program, Michael, it's explained that most people are ruled by the three centers or chakras below the heart chakra, and those are said to govern the motives of money, sex, and power. And we kind of see those, I see, as the principal motives of the elite. Like, for some, it's power, for others, it's greed, and for others, it's sexual deviancy of some type. And it's like these people don't get to that next level of awakening of the human heart, which is where a person would experience remorse of conscience and develop feeling towards other people or his country or his environment. So I see these people, as you say, it's like they're not really elite. You call them the criminal elites. I often call them the elite, so-called, I say. Jim, any comments? I wonder also if sometimes they don't spray as much where they might have their estates or their living spaces. Do you think that's at all true?
Well, I think so. South America, where some of these criminals do have their living spaces, there is less spraying. But again, I was in Taos, New Mexico. Dick Cheney has a home there, and also Donald Rumsfeld. And they spray quite a bit in that region. So it's still baffling, again, to us. But even if they don't spray, we have to realize, you had mentioned, the degree of fallout. Gravity does have an effect. Geoengineers claim, and of course, we don't hold them to a very high regard of honesty, but they claim that, lifetime of those particles are years. So there will be drifting, and they will fall down. So even if you don't see the long trails in our sky, you are breathing in heavy metals. That is not speculation. We have duplicate tests that show that. And if you even look up on a sunny blue sky, our sky is not the deep blue that it was just 10 years ago. It is the silvery blue, and that's because...
Exactly. Like, I noticed some days I've seen that they'll be spraying all day for about 6 hours from when I see it early in the morning through the afternoon, but then by the evening it's all disappeared. And there it seems it must have fallen down. But other days they'll be spraying all day, and it kind of creates a cloud cover, and then it seems to rain within a couple days. But I don't know. I wonder if at different times the spraying, like, it's different substances. They can experiment on us even.
Well, I absolutely think so, and I've spoken with meteorologists who are aware of this and have been studying it. And, yes, there are definitely different sprays. Some days they're very short lines, and they turn into these what appear to be wispy clouds that actually drop down. You can actually see the aerosols dropping from the cloud, almost like a rain, but it's not rain.
Yeah.
It's definitely toxins. But then other days, like you said, the real thick trailing that we have, and then it usually, it's pretty predictable. And again, I've spoken to meteorologists who are well aware of this. They say, yeah, we know when it's going to rain without looking at the radar when they're spraying real heavy, because that enables them, again, to heat up that area and create a lift in that region and steer storms into the area. So, yeah, we're in a season where many different things are being implemented through the use of these programs, and again, none of which is in the best interest of you or I. It's baffling at times.
I remember several years ago I saw a letter that someone had written to a senator in the state somewhere, and it presented an analysis of what the substances chemtrails, and it seemed to include pneumonia or anthrax, desecrated blood particles, that type of viral matter, and now there's concern about nanotechnology. Like, it seems to me that the chemtrail spraying is a delivery system. So it means that if they decide to go hard sell instead of soft sell, that they have this delivery system that they could actually administer much more serious plagues or viruses or poisons to people.
Well, I think it's plausible. I know Clifford Carnicom has done a lot of incredible research in the investigation through the biologicals, and what he uncovered was just really concerning, you know, to those of us who are aware of this. So it definitely is concerning. We know that that experimentation on governments experimenting on citizens, including the U.S., is nothing new. We don't have to look too far to one popular or one well-known incident called the Tuskegee experiment. Since then, there have been many declassified experiments that have been done to the American people. So it certainly is plausible. These programs certainly would enable them to do it. I believe it was John Holdren who spoke about the possibility of inoculating people through the use of aerosol dispersement, as scary as that may sound. So these are things that they're talking about, they're on the table, obviously they're doing them, but there's a denial that these programs have been implemented and again, are in full-scale deployment. So, you know, it's while millions of people have woken up and a lot of people are starting to speak up about this, we still need more. I mean, the gravity of this issue is second to none. I mean, what could be more important than being able to wake up and breathe clean, fresh air? I mean, we can choose what kind of food we eat, we can choose what we smoke, but we cannot choose the air that we breathe, the air that our children breathe, knowing that they're putting these things into our environment, into the environment. The air that our children breathe and not saying anything is actually being complicit with these people. So we're...
That was my experience that day when my partner and I woke up to it, and we were trying to escape the chemtrails, but wherever we went, we were being sprayed. In a way, it's horrifying. In a way, it's a form, I just see it as a form of terrorism, that we don't know what we're being sprayed with. The government's not forthcoming with it. It's not like they really present scientific evidence for the value of the program, which evidence is then subject to scientific inquiry and debate. It's not like that at all. It's all hidden in secrecy. It's all hidden behind wall and wall of lies.
That is correct.
Yeah, it really is truly tragic what's been seen for our society through the past decades, and it's truly tragic. And I thank you, Michael, for your efforts to be out there as a warrior, trying to wake people up. And what can we do? What can people do? If you have other recommendations for people around chemtrails. I try to tell people whenever I go out, when they're chemtrail spraying, I point it out to everybody I meet on the street, and I tell people in the stores and try to get people to look up in the sky. And so I try to spread it just mouth to mouth like that.
I do as well, and I hand out several thousand free DVDs as a result. My community, my neighborhood, is awake to these crimes. So we have lifted the copyright on What in the World Are They Spraying for people who purchase the DVD. So we're encouraging them to make copies and hand out for free. That does a couple of things. Help support the work that I do. I address this 7 days a week, nonstop, and I'm working on some political objectives in getting these programs banned. But DVDs and other information about the products and for activism can be found on whatintheworld.theyspraying.info. And then you can also find more work that I have done in other TV interviews and other articles that I've written on truthmediaproductions.us. But the ideas and the things that we can do are literally limitless. But I think because awareness is still low, it's important to go out with a message. And the film, again, has been a wonderful tool to go out. And we have about a 98% success rate in people who don't believe these programs are occurring. They see the film and then become convinced because of the way that we chose to put it together. So get the film. But there are a number of things that you can do. Organize a screening in your hometown. Go to town hall meetings. Address this issue. Always use the word chemtrail geoengineering because geoengineering is, quote-unquote, a credible science. So I think getting out into public, addressing this, is the most important way. But in Hawaii, we're working on the Clean Sky Ordinance. That's a county ordinance to ban these programs above the island of Maui. We're going to be bringing that ordinance to the other islands. And they're creating an ordinance and holding a public hearing in New York. So, again, that's probably would take us a whole show to talk about objectives. But, again, you can find some other ideas on my website. Again, whatintheworldaretheyspraying.info and truthmediaproductions.us.
Yeah, I'm myself tried to take some of those steps. You know, several weeks ago, months ago, I was up on Parliament Hill in Ottawa. I went up for a 9/11 event, which was held on September 17th, where they showed the architects and engineers new movie about Building 7 and the towers. And I spent the day up on Parliament Hill. And what I did, I took my video camera with me. And what I did was I took pictures of the chemtrails all through the day and tried to show how they accumulated. And I've been making a video which is called A Day in the Life of the Chemtrail Poisoning of the Citizens of Ottawa, Canada by a Psychopathic Elite. And that's the title of that video, which is about 7 to 8 minutes with great shots of the Peace Tower, which has the Rothschild symbol on it. And when I'm on Parliament Hill, they sound the bells of the towers. And in my narration of the video, I say, oh, they're sounding the death knell for the citizens of Ottawa. All the sheep are being sprayed by chemtrail poisoning. I'm a bit of a rascal, Michael. Sorry.
Sounds like it.
I'll try to get a copy of your video. And I agree. I think it's one of the most important issues that we can face. And the issue also is a symptom. It's like this issue is a symptom of what underlies it. Like, people got to wake up. Why would your government allow this to be done to you? Like, people have to face that issue. So it's like, I believe, the New World Order agenda, it could come unraveled from many, many different angles. If we ever had any honorable police or military or politicians at any level, it could be undone in different ways. And I've always felt the chemtrail poisoning, if people realized what's been done to us, that this itself would unravel much of this whole theme of theirs.
I think so. It's a gateway issue, because once people become aware of these truths, it definitely opens them up to a lot of different agendas and to researching things. So that's what we've been told. You know, hey, was totally unawake till I saw your film and became aware of this. And God, after that, I became aware of so many other issues. So we hear that quite frequently. And again, I think everybody needs an entry point to become aware of some of the things that are happening. The film's been effective in that.
Yeah, it's excellent. I did have one other question. Something I've been trying to study is, in watching the clouds, sometimes when you look at the clouds, you can see these wave fronts in the cloud, and it's like if you're looking at the ocean from above, where you can see regular waves all through the clouds. Are those natural clouds? I've always thought that those seem to be entrained somehow through a harp frequency resonance or something. Are you familiar with what I'm where you see the kind of waves in the cloud?
I'm familiar with that, and I've heard many different theories on it. That, and a lot of people do believe that those are waves from the HART program, and
yeah.
I think it's certainly plausible. I have yet to do real research on that, and again, while I think it's something that needs to be investigated, and I think it's probably true, I have yet to see any source documents on it, but definitely worthy of investigation. As many different issues associated with this are, and
yeah.
we will find out for sure someday. There's no question about it because many people are becoming aware, and of course with that we're going to have whistleblowers and a number of people with information coming forward. So it's an exciting time.
And another thing that I'm curious about is I understand that in the States there are said to be over 1,000 biological weapons labs. And I wonder, is there any evidence that one of the things they learn to do in these labs is how to aerosolize particular pathogens? Like, is that part of their research, is how to be able to deliver different substances in an aerosol form? Are you from? Have you ever looked into any of the programs of all these biological labs?
I haven't looked at that yet. But again, I think there are some instances where there have been, it may have been smallpox in New York, where there was testing back in, I believe, the 60s. And I believe it was an aerosolization. So based on that information that's come out, I think it's plausible, you know, certainly that again, is part of what they're studying. But we're talking about top secret labs, and until we get a whistleblower, somebody with source data, I think, you know, again, I think it's plausible, as many things are associated with this. These programs, I believe, go deeper than we could ever imagine.
Yeah.
So I think there are, again, so many different agendas associated with them. At this point, very little would surprise me.
Well, we're coming to the hour, Michael. Could you give out I think have mentioned three sites. Could you give those out again? And
absolutely. For the purchase of the film, and again, we've lifted the copyright for those who purchase the film. Please make as many copies as you can and hand them out for free. It's whatintheworldarethespraying.info. To see more of my work that I've done, you can go to my website, which is truthmediaproductions.us. And you can also go to the Coalition Against Geoengineering, and that's a lot of various information about the issue of geoengineering that G. Edward Griffin and I had put together. So, guys, I really want to thank you for covering this and for bringing this issue to greater light. It's certainly been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Michael, and thanks for coping so nobly with my rather rambunctious remarks and sticking right in it and doing the work you do. We just have to come together, and there's so many issues we need to wake humankind up over, and after a while it all does come together, and in a way it gets simpler and simpler after time to understand it all. But we owe a lot to people you like yourself and J. Edgar Griffin. So thanks, Michael. And if I can, if you would ever like to come back on air with some announcement or updates or anything like that, please contact me, Michael. I would have you back at any time. I really believe in the importance of this chemtrail issue, and you've just convinced me more and more to think 10 to 20 million tons of this stuff is being sprayed down upon us yearly. It's really quite tragic. Thank you, Michael.
Well, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Jim, we've maybe take a break. I've asked Don to set up and play our song Sacred Land, which we often use for an intermission. And Jim and I'll be back in about 5 minutes. Yeah, I'll just hold on.
I stories to tell about a time in this sacred land. The buffalo did roam out on the open plain. The eagle soared high up in the sky. There wasn't any shame, there wasn't any pain. Yes, he said, they were so very proud. They lived a simple life, Mother Nature did provide. There was no law, but there was no crime. He brought his whale alive. Nothing's been the same the day the white man came. Yes, they brought their whiskey and they brought their gun. They took away our land. They put us on the run. Locked us on this reservation. Changed our ways of life. Promises were made, but they were only lies. The nations, they will rise. All the chiefs from long ago, they will be by your side. Into the battleground, a warrior you will ride. Armed with years of wisdom, many years of pride. The day the white man came, he brought his way alive. Nothing's been the same the day the white man came.
Well, that's thank you, Robin, a native Canadian, for a very beautiful piece, Sacred Land. So, Jim, well, that was chemtrails, which have for years now been a major issue for me. And as we've talked about a little bit before, I don't think you get to notice them so much living in the big city. It's harder to see the sky.
Yeah, I mean, I see things. I mean, I don't know what they are. So, I mean, I see my whole reaction to that whole presentation is it's interesting. I'll watch the video. But, like, that's why I asked the question, who is they? Because, like, there's some great leaps of faith and speculation here as to what people are doing and for what purpose. I still, like, the whole idea of population control, I just don't buy it. Something to do to change agriculture, yeah, I could buy that. But like I say, who's doing this? And if it's like on a global scale, who exactly is doing it? It's like,
I think Michael, when he's referring to they, is referring in the general way to what people would call like the New World Order.
Yeah, I don't. That doesn't mean anything to me. It's like I don't buy that. Like I just like yeah. I you know that's I think it's grossly oversimplifying things that are much more complicated than that. I don't know about characterizing Planned Parenthood as a eugenics organization too, as like that seems a little extreme to me. But like the phenomenon itself, I mean, I'm not sure where you would get those figures to as to actually the volume of spraying, but because you'd have to measure it, like, but
no, I think that's what he said was reported to him at this conference he attended on geoengineering.
Well, I'd really like to look at that, like, in much greater detail. Like, as I say, I'm just, you know, I'm not denying that this is like a real problem, because if there's any truth to it, it's obviously it's a huge problem. But it's just I'm color me skeptical I think it's definitely worth investigating, and definitely it is something that to be concerned about. And I wouldn't put anything past anybody in terms of spraying and detoxifying things, but
it's like anything is not impossible anymore.
I'm certainly in that camp. I mean, anything is possible, but at the same time, it's like, I'd have to learn a lot more. I definitely will watch the film. I'd be very interested to see his film. So,
Oh, yeah, do watch that. Yeah. It's really good. And, yeah. Okay, so, well, anyway, we weren't going to talk about New World Order today. We were going to try to pick up. We've been discussing one book, which we'll go back to. And I want to mention this new movie called Thrive. And just in speaking with Doug at BBS off air, he was saying a number of people at BBS have had the producer of this movie on their shows, which is very good. This is a remarkable movie, this movie Thrive, and a lot of twists and turns to it. And we're going to come back to it. Jim's going to watch it for our next show, and I think we'll dedicate our next show to this movie and kind of go through some of the substance of it, because it begins with very interesting discussions of torus structures and kind of the geometry of toruses. And it so ties into what things I would argue in terms of zero-point dynamics and the nature of the heart center and so on. And even at the end of the movie, he mentions about any toroidal structure having a zero-point center. And it's a very profound movie, some of the early materials. And they're talking about, like, anti-gravity devices and kind of new understanding in physics. And he has that fascinating physicist on, Hakeem Harriman, who's very interesting work. But it's a very good movie, and he goes into the nature of the torus and its applications and how they think this is like a universal growth pattern in nature. And he goes into the geometry of it, all which ties in very nicely with my own work. It really gave me a lot of impetus, kind of new ideas for the next kind of phases of my writing. And then in the movie, he starts talking about alternate energy technologies and anti-gravity and magnetism and things. And then it kind of leads into a review of all these different energy technologies that have been suppressed. And then it kind of goes on and looks then at the whole kind of world situation and what's happening in the world, the broader scene. So it's one of those far-reaching movies, kind of along the line of the movie Zeitgeist, which became very popular several years ago now. But I would recommend to people you watch this movie, Thrive, and it's really quite an inspirational movie. And next show, we're going to focus on that movie. Jim and I both have watched it again, and we'll open the lines up and create discussion around the movie Thrive. And I'm going to put some links up on my website to encourage people to watch that movie, which is available through Video, Google, or YouTube. Okay, so then, Jim, last show we were kind of discussing this book, consciousness beyond life. The science of the near-death experience. And I didn't know if a call here. I'm going to have to switch for a minute, Jim. I'll be right back.
Hello? Hello? Oh, Jim, are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I was getting a beep that is interfering. Sorry, I'm going to just switch back.
Okay. Any comments, Jim? Do you want to pick up on this at all, or do you remember how far we'd gotten? I was kind of drawing from some of the notes I'd taken as I read the book. We were both impressed with the quality of the scholarship and inquiry in the book.
Yeah, because he goes into quite a comprehensive review of the literature, and he talks about his own long-term study that he did, and then he gets into what are the implications of this experience for our understanding of the nature of consciousness and life, and I think he comes to the only logical conclusion that the materialist position it simply is inadequate to explain consciousness and life, and that something much that these experiences are indicating that something much more profound is going on, and really points to the whole inadequacy of the materialist explanation of things. And he has a lot of there are a lot of very good books on the near-death experience. I think this is like one of the most interesting and important areas in scientific research in the last 50 or 60 years, especially, and it's funny because it's somewhat of a medical anomaly and phenomena that's been studied, but it's got profound spiritual and psychological implications, and it really poses huge questions for our understanding of the nature of consciousness and the nature of life itself, and so it kind of crosses several different disciplines, and I think this phenomenon is so interesting and has led to such interesting research, and there have been several very good books and investigations by medical doctors and psychologists over the last 30 years or so, it's so interesting. We talked about this before. Several of the leading investigators started out as skeptics, and then when they really looked at this phenomenon of the near-death experience, they came to the conclusion that, no, there's something here inexplicable that's happening, something that is real and that can't be reduced to conventional materialist explanations. It's not a case of anoxia, and it's not a case of people experiencing releases of certain chemicals, even though that in the case of chemicals, there may be something to that in terms of a physiological basis for this. But it's such an interesting phenomenon that I think in this book that Dr. Van Lommel has really brought all the other people together. I see his book as kind of a culmination, and it's going to lead to further growth in terms of trying to explain consciousness in a very different way, which will put this experience in a very different context, and which will result from these experiences sort of providing the evidence that the conclusive evidence that the materialist explanation of consciousness simply is inadequate. And I, that's why I think this is such an important, I think it's a very important book. I think this whole phenomenon is very important.
Yeah, I agree with your assessment of the book. In fact, if anyone asked me what can I read on near-death experiences, I've read everything from Raymond Moody's through a fairly wide range of materials, and I would recommend this above any other work because it not only summarizes the main experiences people have, but then it goes through all the alternate explanations systematically and discredits them. And then he faces this issue most gravely of all the people I've read, is what does this mean about the issue of consciousness? And he does solve it. He has different suggestions which he thinks could be part of the mystery, but he doesn't think he has a solution to this problem. He brings the literature together to realize to illustrate to us how profound a mystery this is, and that there's no way of avoiding it. It like reminds me of what Nick Herbert said in a book on quantum theory, where he talks about non-locality. And he kind of says, like, physicists hate non-locality, but the scientific evidence shows the universe is non-local.
Yeah.
It's absolutely inherent to quantum theory, and the evidence is all documented. So in a way, it's like it doesn't matter what you like or don't like. You know, the fact is the evidence is point to non-locality. And I think here the evidence is what they point to is somehow human beings are able to maintain consciousness for periods of time, not extended periods of time, but periods of time apart from the body completely. And that even while these people are apart from their bodies, they still have the psychological functions which we normally have. Meaning they're still capable of thinking, of feeling, of perception, of memory, and of consciousness, awareness. So in many ways, they feel completely themselves, but they're completely dissociated from the material body. And I've always felt I remember 30 years ago reading this experience, and when I read how people outside of their body felt almost exactly the same as what they felt when they were inside their body, that in a way proved to me or led me to believe that even when we're in the body, the consciousness was never being produced by the body. That somehow there is something left undefined for the moment, which somehow inhabits the body, that the body somehow is a vehicle for some consciousness or self of some kind. And this author is very good, and he doesn't shy away from bringing out that realization. And then he explores a number of alternative ideas about consciousness, none of which really impressed me too much. And we'll go through some of his comments on consciousness. But yeah, I think we both agree, Jim, the value of this book, and it kind of it focuses on the issue that is the main focus of our show here, which is like what is the nature of human consciousness? And I think this is the most adequate book from a scientific vantage point, which in a way documents the fact that we have to consider alternate models of consciousness. Models of consciousness where the consciousness is not being produced by neurological processes in the brain or even by the body at all, but that there's some higher dimensional structure to human existence. And also these accounts of people's experiences also not only point to the continuation or possible continuation of human existence beyond death, but it also points to the existence of other dimensions or planes of existence. There are realms that these people go to, even if their realms are somehow within their own minds, is beside the fact for the moment. But there are places that these people enter into and encounter other beings who have other consciousnesses and perceptions and so on. But there's actually, not only does his book raise the enigmas of human consciousness, but even the more profound issue of where are these other dimensions and how is this possible that consciousness persists into these other realms.
I think I agree with you about what you said about he comes to the conclusion that you really have to look at consciousness as being non-local, but then he doesn't really present anything I think that's very compelling, and certainly I think this is where his argument kind of comes to he gets stalled a bit, I would say, because I don't think he makes reference to in some ways to some spiritual teachings and some esoteric teachings, but he doesn't develop that material. And I was thinking, like, I mean, when I was reading this book, I kept thinking he should read your book on the heart doctrine, because I think he would be, I think he'd find it very interesting, and it certainly provides a perspective that he doesn't recognize. Ironically, he's a cardiologist, I think that it at least provides a model that would be congruent with what he's concluded based on his research into this experience and why he suggests that the current explanation of consciousness is totally inadequate and has to lead to some sort of a non-local model. And I like the fact that you brought up Nick Herbert's comments, because I think that's right on the money, because Herbert's talking about, as you say, the phenomenon of non-locality in physics and how loath physicists are to really deal with the implications of what this means. It's like David Bohm says something to the effect that physicists pretend kind of they recognize that the non-locality exists, like when they're at work, but then they go home to their local world and they kind of forget about it, and it colors their thinking, and people aren't really willing to pursue the implications of what their research has shown them, and most astounding implications of what their research has shown them. And I think this is very much the parallel situation here with this the experience of the near-death experience, its implications for what for psychology and for biology and in some peculiar way even for cosmology, as you say, like where do people go when they have these experiences? Yes, they're still in their minds, but their minds aren't quite what they are when they're in their physical bodies, and this opens up a whole host of interesting questions. And ironically, what's so interesting about this is that it's modern medicine, and which is grounded in a materialist framework, assumptive framework and perspective, which has led to the documenting and providing the evidences which really undermine the whole materialist framework, and very much like in modern physics, like the search for the ultimate building blocks of life led to the idea and the recognition that there really isn't such, there is no thing at the heart of being. There's nothingness at the heart of being, in a sense. So it's like it's ironic, but there's a certain parallel between, I think, modern physics and what's happened with this in terms of modern psychology and to a certain extent biology too, because these are very, very big questions posed by these experiences. You can't get around this. Like, you can't avoid this, the implications of what these experiences mean. And I think, like, we've gone to a certain extent. I think one of the things von Lommel's book does is anybody who reads this with an open mind, and there'll be lots of people with closed minds who won't be able to acknowledge this, but anybody who reads it with an open mind, I think, has to come to the conclusion that we should stop asking if these experiences are real and try to understand that not only that they're real, but try to understand what they actually mean.
And how could it work?
How could it work? Yeah. I mean,
that's what, as we've mentioned before, I think that's kind of where you and I were both at, like almost 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. We kind of forgot trying to prove that there's a phenomena to explain. In a way, for me, I just accepted that at a certain point in studying near-death experiences, but also studying the evidences for other psychical phenomena, I arrived at a point that I just said, okay, I don't need more evidence. I'm convinced through my research of people who I did believe were somewhat competent scientists, because there are a lot of good scientists who have done research in this area, you know, from Pearson at Duke University and Sheldrake's work, all kinds of people. So there is good scientific research for it, and there's so many compatible different areas of research which all reinforce the same concept, like that man is not simply a material being, but somehow can manifest or experience extended faculties of the mind or the heart or consciousness, however that might work, and that there is evidences, like how I remember thinking, well, if there are all these other dimensions, because everybody, when they have a near-death experience, doesn't experience the same thing. Although some elements are common, I mean, some people will hang around their medical emergency. Other people will go down the tunnel into a heavenly type of realm. Other people will just encounter, they don't go down the tunnel, but they encounter loved ones in some other realm. So other people go into hellish type worlds. So there are, so not only can we persist beyond death, but there's various possibilities beyond death or out of our body where we might pass into, realms we might pass into. And these are a variable quality, everything from heaven world to hell world. And people also describe realms where it's like there's all these, the land of the damned. I think we were reading a quote last week from this book where he was talking about the society of the damned. And it's like hell worlds where people don't know where they are, but they're just filled with like hatred, negative emotion. And it's interesting that all these kinds of evidences are really very consistent with the type of teaching Madame Blavatsky was giving back in the late 1800s, because she was explaining, not only Blavatsky, but within the mystical literature, that we have several bodies. We don't just have a physical body, but we also have an astral body, and we also have a mental body. Okay, and those are often regarded as the three lower bodies. Sometimes people mention also an etheric body, but the etheric body, as I understand it, is not a separate body, but it serves as an interface between the astral, mental, and the physical. So it's not a separate body in itself, but usually in the occult literature, the three lower bodies are regarded as the mental, astral, and physical. And the astral and physical are said to have different qualities. Like, if you travel in your astral body, you can have the sensation of moving through space. So you can actually kind of like move through space in your astral body. And add certain people have described certain limiting speeds. But in your mental body, it's like your mental body is instantaneous. Like you might think of your mental body as, say, it could propagate at the speed of light. Well, light travels so fast that you could go around the Earth six times in a second, I think. Light is so fast. So in your mental body, you could have different properties and experiences than you might have in your astral body. You see, so it's not just like there's this world and then the next. Instead, what I think these evidences showed is that there is a multidimensional universe and there are various possibilities for afterlife existence and entities on these different planes. And this has long been explored within teachings of theosophy and yoga and Tibetan Buddhism and elsewhere, even though different people in different traditions have different terms for the different bodies and different understanding of the planes, etc. But still, within the mystical tradition, it's been suggested, I would say for a long time, the human being has various bodies. Gurdjieff calls them, he says we have higher being bodies. We have a physical body, but then we have a Kesajan body, which is your astral body, and then we have a mental body, which he associates with the spiritual body. So I think the evidences not only point to continuity of consciousness through death, but also it points to the fact of being within a multidimensional universe. And I felt for 30 years that if this is true, there has to be a physics to it. Like, you know, if these worlds exist, then they are composed of some substance of some type. Like they said, the astral world is composed of astral matter, just like the physical world is composed of physical matter. And the mental world is said to be made of mental matter. So we can imagine different materials of different densities or levels of refinement. And Gurdjieff says we have to develop our higher being bodies through accumulating more energies in our astral and mental body and refining them as vehicles for the soul life. So I think Jim, his book kind of points to all of these kinds of possibilities as worthy of consideration, and it kind of suggests that, you know, these mystical teachings through the ages have really been pointing to something that's always been there, but it's just we who have, I think, in the name of science, we kind of, science reacted all to the supernatural. When science wanted to come out from the umbrella of religion and establish itself in its own right, and in a way, it kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, with the, getting rid of religious dogmas, but at the same time, it got rid of the whole psychology of the whole and of the soul, or the psychology of spirit, or the idea of multidimensional universe. And those basic ideas have been taught within all the esoteric traditions for hundreds and thousands of years. So I think his book kind of, as you say, it kind of is the best I've ever read, I think, to bridge the world of science and then looking more seriously at what it all suggests.
Yeah, he talks about in the last time we were sort of going through the book, and it was before Chapter 9, which is when chapter's called What Do We Know About Brain Function, and he goes into, he says it's now becoming increasingly clear that brain activity in itself cannot explain consciousness. And then he kind of goes through a very good discussion of kind of the limits of the current methodological approach, and which characterizes neuroscience, where people are trying to look for the so-called neural correlates of consciousness, and they do that through like functional magnetic resonance imaging and PET scans and various tools. But what he shows is that really, first of all, as everybody ever taken a science course knows, that correlation doesn't imply causation. It just means two things are associated with one another. And then he talks about the contents of consciousness and how really these tools are utterly inadequate in terms of explaining the contents of consciousness. And then he goes into a little bit of a review of kind of some of the major anomalies and enigmas within the research on the brain. Like he talks a bit about John Lorber's work. Lorber published a very famous article in Science magazine in, I think, 1980, called Is Your Brain Necessary?, where he talks about somebody who had superior intellectual abilities but had basically had no brain, had a very, very small, thin level of cortex, and then the brain was just filled with fluid, cerebral spinal fluid, and there were apparently that phenomenon, which I've never really been able to find more information about, but apparently it's not an isolated case that he talks about. There have been several cases that some people are intellectually cognitively impaired, but many others are superior cognitively, and it's a very interesting phenomenon in and of itself, another major anomaly within the current understanding of the current assumptive framework of that the brain produces consciousness. And he sort of takes apart this idea and says that it's really, really, really inadequate. And then he makes reference to, he talks a little bit about that there have been many major brain scientists in the last 75 years, like Wilder Penfield, Charles Sherrington, Sir John Eccles. I mean, these are major figures in the history of neurology, Carl Prebram, who have come to the conclusion that the mind and the brain are two different things, and that the brain is an instrument of consciousness, but there's something... that mind somehow exists apart from the brain, and he makes the point. He's talking about the placebo effect, and he also talks a little bit about Mario Beauregard, the Montreal neurologist, very interesting work about how the brain can actually be changed by the mind, and he makes reference to Daniel Dennett and Susan Blackmore, who claim that essentially the mind is just the idea that consciousness exists is is an illusion. And he says, well, how does an illusion change the physical brain itself? Because there's quite striking evidence that the mind somehow can change the brain. So there's a very interesting discussion in that chapter. I just, as I said, I just sort of reviewed it today, and I was really struck by, I think he really identifies some of the major anomalies and enigmas within the current field of neuroscience and neurology and their assumption that somehow the brain is producing consciousness. I mean, absolutely nobody can document this in any way, because essentially it doesn't happen. So there's that small problem. So as I say, it's a very, very interesting discussion, and that sets him up for exploring the ideas of moving beyond a materialist position to somehow understand consciousness as being non-local. But that's when I think that the book starts to break down a bit, because I don't think he really has developed that material that well.
No, I agree with that. Like, he has that basic concept where he's saying that there's something non-local about consciousness. But to bridge non-local consciousness to local consciousness, like, that gap is like an explanatory gap, like that's not filled in. But I think he recognizes that. I mean, he states that. He looks at different possible alternative explanations, but he doesn't really arrive at what he thinks definitively in any way. You were mentioning some of the neuro, you mentioned Penfield, and I remember reading one of Penfield's books called The Mysteries of the Mind, and Penfield became very well known in Montreal for doing surgery on epileptic patients when they were fully conscious. And what he did was stimulate different parts of the brain, and people would experience different phenomena. I remember one example, a woman kind of seeing a butterfly and having this whole experience of this butterfly flying around her. This is one example. But Penfield says, but whenever he produced phenomena like that, the person always knew in a way that it was being done to them. That it wasn't like they were witnesses. So the person would see, oh, the happy butterfly fluttering around. But they knew that somehow they had that separation from that. Well, that would be what I would call an object of conscious experience. Like, this electrical stimulation provides an object for conscious, to be conscious of, but it doesn't produce the consciousness or mind itself. And Penfield explains how, although different electrical stimulation of the brain might tie into experiencing this or that phenomena, the electrical stimulation could never account for the minding, which seemed to be witness to it all. And that was kind of how Penfield explained the mystery of the mind, and that there was no way that the mind, our knowledge about the brain, could account for consciousness. That was Penfield's conclusion. And then there was Eccles and other scientists. I had a couple other quotes there, Jim, from the book that I was going to just skip around a little bit with a few quotes. One on page 82. And whenever I read a book, certain things always stand out to me. Well, some of the things are when people talk about the heart, because I always try to find the heart doctrine in different teachings. And also, if people mention the idea of there being a divine spark or a divine element in the human being, I always latch on to that idea, because that's what I explain through the zero-point teaching, is this idea of there being a God spark or divine spark within the human being. And I relate it to the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. So anyway, when I see people refer to the heart and sparks and such, I often glom on those quotes. So here's a quote. He says, talking about the universal idea about death, and he relates it to the Egyptian Book of the Dead from the Papyrus of Ani about 1250 BC. People believe that after death, the soul leaves the earth and sets off on a journey through the underworld, where a final challenge awaits the deceased before he can enter the hereafter, the judgment of Osiris. This involved the enumeration of a long list of sins which the deceased denied committing. The truth of this denial was then established by weighing the heart against a feather. If the deceased spoke the truth and the heart was not weighed down by sin, he or she would be ensured of blissful immortality within sight of the sun god. But a dreadful fate awaited those who failed the test of truth, as these sinners were condemned to eternal oblivion. I don't agree with the eternal oblivion. It's something like the Blavatsky secret doctrine. You certainly don't have eternal oblivion, eh, Jim? Because nothing's eternal. Like, the root principles of creation are eternal. But any created cosmos, it kind of emerges from a point, it grows within, without, eventually it contracts without, within, back to a point, and back into the nothingness. So nothing material is eternal. Even life in hell isn't eternal. I think that flies in the face of all the mystical teachings, which see there are more cyclical. They see there's a coming and going, like Blavatsky says, the suns expand and contract. It's like things expand and come into being and then contract, withdraw into a higher dimension.
That might be a bit of poetic license, but it'd be a long time, though. I guess that's what the idea is. That, you know, I mean, I don't know if he's extrapolating that or if he's, you know, like, I don't know. But
no, but you often hear this, like Christians will say, like, you go to hell and you kind of eternal suffering.
Yeah, no, I
think that's fanciful. I don't believe that. And in my study of the mystical literature, doesn't lead me to believe that. I think there are realms that we can be drawn into, like hellish type worlds, where time is so slow it might seem eternal.
Yeah, well, that's what I think that they're getting at. But
yeah, anyway, you can't have any evidence that they're eternal worlds, because if they were, because someone would have had to have lived eternally to know that. So it doesn't make sense. How can anyone tell you that it's eternal?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, another thing from the book. Okay, I like this. This is quoting from ancient India, I think from the Upanishad. He says, coming and going is all pure delusion. The soul neither comes nor goes. Where is the place to which it shall go when all space is in the soul? When shall be the time for the entering and departing when all time is in the soul? And I like this quote because my studies of occultism, in a way, lead to an alternate model of the nature of space in terms of the holographic principle. Because Blavatsky also says, in a way, that space and location is an illusion. And it doesn't mean that it's not real, but it's only real on a certain level of perception. And in my understanding, it's like, I would say the monadic essence or the self is established in higher dimensional space. So from the perspective of that perspective, there is no soul coming or going anywhere. It is always where it is. And that's what I want, the soul neither comes nor goes. And I think that's an interesting concept, that, and it corresponds to what I say, that a human being has a monadic essence established in seven-dimensional hyperspace. Okay, this, for people not familiar with our craziness, this is the kind of concepts we try to explore. So you have a monadic essence established in higher dimensional space, and the coming and going is more the illusion manufactured around or surrounding that central self or a point. You think that gives a little bit, Jim, of what I'm trying to say? You know, I'm trying to talk about this alternate conception of space that arises out of mystical teachings, because in a way, mystics say that the whole universe, in a way, is implicated in any point.
Yeah.
In a way, the whole is everywhere. And Blavatsky says that. She says there's one omniscient which thrills throughout every finite point of the universe. So it's like we live in a sea of holographic information where knowledge about the whole is latent or present everywhere throughout that whole, which is the idea of holography, which means to write the whole. So we just see that holographic concept in this ancient Upanishad. Okay, here, page 87, I had another. It's in, again, it's from ancient India. He's quoting from the Katha Upanishad. And the eternal self slays not, nor is ever slain. Hidden in the heart of every creature exists the self, subtler than the subtlest, greater than the greatest. And here, Jim, it struck me in reading this book, it's like, well, here he is. He's like quoting this Upanishad verse, but doesn't he realize what it just said? Like it just said, hidden in the heart of every creature self.
Yeah, well, that's what I've said so many times before in this program is that, you know, I read a lot of this material and I didn't realize it until you started pointing out that it's in everything. It's the heart doctrine is in all of these esoteric teachings. It's right there. It's staring you in the face. But I think people read it metaphorically and don't realize that it's meant to be literally true.
Yeah, exactly. They take it metaphorically. Like it sounds poetic.
Yeah, it's very poetic.
You know, like, you can say to someone, oh, the truth is in your heart. And, oh, that's nice. I'll take that. You know, I like that. Valentine's, you know. I don't love someone with all my head. I love them with all my heart. So, yeah. So
but
I'll take it
also,
poetically.
And also
but in a way, it's like there's these. It's like Blavatsky says the heart doctrine. She says, great sifter is the heart doctrine. And that often reminds me, I think, of what I've done a bit in my life, is I've studied this different esoteric literature and tried to sift it, meaning like to find those nuggets of gold, like the some of the profound truths in mystical teachings. And as Blavatsky says, the heart doctrine, she says, great sifter is the name of the heart doctrine. So it's like, and if you do that with mystical literature, if you sift through it, you find, as Jim was just saying, the heart doctrine in the Upanishads, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Kabbalistic teachings, in Judaism, in native teachings, in Blavatsky's secret doctrine. You find it so widely in genuine esoteric teachings. The self is connected to the heart. And I would say in New Agey teachings, they want to identify the self, the higher self, and they often want to put it up over top of the head, or they want to relate it to the seventh crown chakra. And I would agree that awakening the seventh crown chakra can give you these kind of ultimate experiences, nirvanic and blissful type experiences, but that's not the seat of the self, which I would connect to the heart. But the idea is if the self is awakened in the heart, then the light of self can illuminate the throat chakra, the eye chakra, or the crown chakra. So that's why Blavatsky says the doctrine of the eye is for the crowd. And you see in modern times, that's what people identify the doctrine of the eye. That's the Illuminati symbol.
the eye of dogma within the pyramid. But Blavatsky says the doctrine of the heart is for the elect. So she's saying that it's deeper teaching. And as Jim was saying, once one begins to hear this idea, and as you read esoteric literature, you begin to find it more and more. And I think it's one of those gold nuggets that we, you know, it's an idea that we can take it in as an idea. So you might say to someone, well, I think the self is in the heart, and that's what all the mystics say. Okay, and so you can know it as an intellectual idea, but really what we need is for that idea to then help bring us to the direct experiences of these things. And that's what we aim for. And that's what seems to happen to mystics, is that they have direct experiences of these things, and then they recount their experiences. They put it often in kind of poetic form, like the Upanishads or Gita. It's like mystical poetry. Okay, so I'll move along here. On page 89, he says, according to this doctrine of Vedanta, pure consciousness has a primary presence in the universe, while our mind is merely a spark or a reflection of this consciousness. So here's one of those places where he uses the idea, Jim, of a spark. And I think we often find this, like, in the holographic paradigm. Like, even Carl Prebram had this idea. It's like there's the kind of infinite light consciousness, but then there each person has a spark of that, or they have one element of that. Oh, no, I'm thinking of Aldous Huxley. He says we're all potentially mind at large, but it's like each person's body somehow helps to focus an individualized consciousness out of that mind at large. So Huxley and other people see the mind as a reducing valve that in a way blocks out the infinite so that a person can have a finite identity and existence. Another quote, page 89, he's talking about Tibetan Buddhism, which says, death is like sleeping. And the bardo, a bardo means, he says, the intermediate state immediately after death lasts a maximum for 49 days and is like a dream between death and a new life. The soul begins its new life, according to the Tibetan Buddhist, usually on the 50th day after death. And this is a very important teaching that you find throughout the mystical literature describing the structure of the universe, that mystics describe creation as having seven planes of existence. And often each of the seven planes is then said to have seven subplanes. So that gives you a total of 49 states of existence. And that's what the person's saying here you have in Tibetan Buddhism. You have seven planes of existence, each with seven subplanes. And this is like how someone like Blavatsky, how she explains what happens to a person after death. Gurdjieff as well, because they say in your astral body, for instance, you have seven densities of astral matter. So if you in your life have a lot of dense, coarse negative emotions, you accumulate more of these dense astral matters in your astral body, so that when you pass over, your afterlife fate is a natural product of your own psychology. Okay, because of your astral body and your astral makeup, you're drawn to certain level of vibratory existence within the astral plane. So if you're
if you have, say, loving relationships with your parents or grandparents and they've passed over, well, then that feeling of loving relationship to them might draw you into the realm where they exist, that you might encounter them. Okay, whereas if your life has been based on kind of deviancy and cruelty and such, then you'll be drawn into these lower levels of the astral plane. And we noticed in that quote I read earlier, Jim, it was interesting. They say if the heart, if it's not weighed down by sin, it says, then he or she will be insured of blissful immortality within sight of the sun god. And this is another interesting thing, how many mystics see the sun as a level of kind of spiritual existence and spiritual realization. And I've often thought that the way in which people travel down a tunnel into a realm of light, and I think if you look at the world around you, where would such a realm of light be? And it makes perfect sense in the way that it would be the sun. And indeed, different mystics associate the spiritual world with the sun, including Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff relates the sun to the spiritual body, and then he relates the divine level of self to the level of the starry world, which is beyond the sun. I know, Jim, we're coming down. We just have a few minutes. Anything, any concluding comments? We'll continue with this a little bit more, and we'll pick up on the movie Thrive next week.
Yeah, I think, well, I was going to say, I think we should talk a little bit about light, because I think that's where sort of we were sort of kind of heading, and there's some very interesting material in that book about light, and we could talk about that a bit, too.
Yeah, let's do that, because I still have a series of quotes here, and each quote I have, it allows us to go into, you know, another of these very important and kind of profound subjects.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. Great. Okay, well, I'd like to thank you, Jim, for being here, and do watch that movie, Thrive. I'm putting it out there today. We're going to have a call-in show next in 2 weeks' time, and invite. We'll do an opening talking about the movie, and then we'll open it up. And thank you, Doug, at BBS Radio there today. And I would encourage people, go to my website at www.zeropoint.ca. And I haven't revised my website for a while now, but I hope to get around to it this week. I've been finishing off this newest book that I've produced, which I actually hope is going to be available in 2 weeks, Jim.
Oh, okay, good.
I even gave it a new title. You know how before it was going to be called God's Contracting Universe?
Right.
Now the title is, I'll explain this later, it's 11:37, God's Contracting Universe. So I put that number because, you know, I mean, you're familiar with how we often say the formula, God is first one, then three, then seven. So there's kind of mystery or meaning in this number, but we'll come back to this in the weeks to come. I hope within 2 weeks that book will be available. And otherwise, we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thank you, Jim Moffat. This is Christopher Holmes. Thank you, BBS Radio. Remember yourselves. Don't give up. We got to keep heart. We got to have courage to face these times upon us. Okay, thank you all. Goodbye.
Thanks a lot.